October 2004, over 3 million people flooded into the streets of Boston on a rainy afternoon. It was absurdly crowded, and a sharp bite of New England autumn cut right through the well-worn sweatshirt and beaten-up ball caps of Red Sox Nation. Still, none of the fans felt the cold quite as sharply as they would any other day, and no self-respecting Bostonian wanted to be at work that day anyway. It was an ocean of humanity. Wave after wave of people came to this place, transported by something they cared about so deeply that it defied reason, convenience, and any reasonable fear of traffic problems, getting them to the city that day on the most crowded afternoon in Boston history. 3 million or so in number. People who wouldn't have missed this for the world, 3 million strong of every gender, political view, ethnicity, religion, and socioeconomic class, were standing there united just this once by a single shared desire to see the faces of their 2004 World Series champions, the Boston Red Sox. They spoke of the players in eloquent soliloquies, tears streaming down their faces in an almost religious expression of reverence and joy. They hung off of bridges just to get a closer look at their heroes and to let them, their team, know just what it meant to them to finally win one. They turned the great big shining dome of MIT, one of America's finest universities, into a huge baseball, and they blocked off every street just so that the heroes could get by. It was the world's largest parade, and nobody wanted it ever to end, because the 2004 World Series was more than just a win for the Red Sox. It was more even than just a win for the current denizens of Red Sox Nation. It was a win for generations upon generations of fans, and in the end, it was a win for the idiots. The unpolished, unfancy, unshaven rabble that most everyone had given up on. It was a win for the people who always lost. And it was a win for the people who didn't have to be perfect to be everything they ever wanted to be. I was ordained by this congregation on October 22nd, 2004. 2 days before that, on October 20th, the Red Sox had sealed the deal on the greatest postseason comeback in the history of Major League Baseball, taking an 0-3 deficit to the New York Yankees and turning it around into an unlikely 4-3 win for the Red Sox. Now, given the fact that I was getting ready to marry into a family of major Red Sox fans, I considered a deep honor that anyone even bothered to show up for my ordination, especially given the fact that I did not have cable, so no one would be able to watch any lead up to the game. Decamping from Boston right in the middle of the lead up to the World Series was love indeed, and I figured these people really were my family. Because I knew how much the Boston Red Sox meant to my new family. I knew how much that games I would hardly even have noticed meant to their lives. This was a chance that not only my family, but so many families all over America had been waiting for all those long 86 years for. 86 years since the Red Sox had won a World Series, 86 years of tears, 86 years of failure, 86 years of unreasonable hope. 86 years wherein some families never did stop believing that it would all eventually come back around, and 86 years in which a great many people died still wishing they had seen that day when that pennant could fly. In the wake of that victory, people went to cemeteries and left Red Sox caps on their grandfather's grave. They were carried away by something more fundamental than a sporting event. And to be honest, it all seemed a little wacky to me from the outside. For they were riding on the crest of their sheer exuberance into a sense of identity and community that many of them had not felt in a very long time. And to be honest, a little piece of me was jealous. I wish I had been a Red Sox fan for 86 years. One fan, remembering what it was like to watch the final game of that World Series, describes the emotions that she felt, and this helped to clarify for me how this was so much more than just a game. She said, "I didn't speak from the top of the eighth until the game ended. I was having trouble breathing. I felt dizzy, lightheaded, and when it was over, I began to sob uncontrollably. People all around me were jumping, yelling, dancing, hugging, and I was weeping." And then we all went outside, out onto Brookline Avenue, and for about 15 seconds, there was this strange feeling in the air. No one dared break the silence. We had done it. Nobody knew what to do. So I got in my car, I rolled down the windows, and I went home and called my dad. Her story is not unusual. So many people, so many families, so many stories, they all collected together on the streets of that city on a cold October day, and what they found for just a brief time was a shared rejoicing that trumped all other differences. It was like a magic spell, like Cinderella's enchantments that would wear off at midnight. It would last maybe only for a day, or maybe only for as long as it took for that bright sense of unity and community to dissipate in the cold New England air, but it was magic while it was there. For a brief time, Red Sox fans forgave one another and their team everything. Sons and fathers who hadn't talked in months, neighbors who usually only muttered complaints about one another under their breaths, bar patrons who elbowed each other for room, politicians who were busy plotting each other's demise, and siblings who thought they didn't have anything in common anymore. For a moment, they forgave each other everything. They were in this together, and this victory belonged to all of them. When Richard told me about the topic he had chosen for this sermon, of course, we shared some stories of our common relationship to the Red Sox. After all, he and I both came to our Red Sox fanhood through somewhat unusual circumstances, mine through marriage, and his through becoming an expatriate of the land of soccer when he moved from England to Boston. See, before meeting my husband John, I never would have guessed that I, Nancy McDonald Ladd, would one day have a large autographed poster of a man named Big Poppy worth more than much of my furniture hanging in my house. And when Richard was growing up in England, this American sport was probably not the first thing on his mind. But the Red Sox and Big Poppy, apparently, are part of my family now. Even my very Midwestern Cardinal fan dad has a t-shirt that says Yankee hater. And when Richard moved to Boston, he adopted that place. Not just as a place to be or a place to live, a while to reside in this place, but as a home. He adopted that team as his own. He found in baseball a force that was powerful enough to reverse some of the loneliness of a new and different land, and he wondered at the power of this game to galvanize an entire city. Becoming a fan was his way of really throwing in his lot with his community. It was his way of saying, "I am here among you, I am one of you," and being a fan meant that he was a part of something bigger than himself. He was a part of the world around him. And this place, these people, this team was home to him. Being a fan to Richard and to my family is a source of identity. It's a little piece of oneself that you choose to share with a strange and scattered smattering of humanity. It's a kinship that transcends traditional societal boundaries and connects people who would otherwise never actually interact with one another. We live in an increasingly fragmented society. There are all sorts of reasons for that. Where in generations past, families in America and all over the world tended to find their place to call their own and settle down, many generations living in close proximity to each other, today, the Washington, D.C. area in which we live is indicative of a broader switch that moves us away, away, away from the hometown and out into a wide diaspora where people follow the jobs and jobs follow the economy. And in this fragmented society of ours, once you've been a place long enough to feel like you're at home, the next move is underway and the wheel turns again. Certainly here in Manassas, the old families who have been here for generations have felt the pressure of change. As people move into the area from all around the country and all around the world, the sense of what it is to be community here has to adapt. For many of us here now are people who do not, like those generations-long Manassans, know every clot of dirt, every bit of the lay of the land, every curvature of every furrow, and every bit of history. There are so many like us, transplants from elsewhere, who come here to live because we found the opportunities we need here and who hunger to find a way to create community within that. We are a commuting, moving, building, shifting society, and our sense of identity, for the most part, is no longer attached definitively to our sense of place. Many of us don't even know our neighbors, and I can count on one hand the number of families in our congregation that regularly have more than two generations worshiping together among us. Certainly, the television we watch and the company we keep serves to further fragment us. Where once everyone turned on the TV to watch the evening news on one of, like, three channels, today, people largely get their news based upon their preconceived political opinions. Republicans watch O'Reilly, Democrats watch Olbermann, and never the twain shall meet. The gulf of separation is wide and deep on so many levels. And the traditional ways of finding and making community just don't come through for us in the same way anymore. We Americans are a people divided into pockets, not just racially and ethnically segregated, though who can deny the presence of that, but according to our politics, our religious convictions, even our manner of dress. There are not many sources of identity, many pieces of selfhood that transcend these pockets of segregation and tell us that we are a part of something so big it makes our differences pale in comparison. And when we have lived too long isolated from that transcendent sense of being a part of something, when we go too long being cut off from a real sense of community, some little part of our soul starts to wither. The increasing fragmentation of our society results for many of us not only in a certain rootlessness, but also a general state of isolation. We have a sense we don't really belong to the people in our lives anymore. It's as if each person is an island in the midst of a million other islands, all so close, but cut off by a gulf we can't quite manage to cross. And then, ever so often, something crosses the gulf, sweeps away our disconnection, forces us to reach out to people we barely even saw before. What does this? Clearly, there are sporting events. The occasional religious experience, perhaps. Often our children, and most definitely crisis, the World Series and the World Trade Center, joy and sorrow, wonder and grief. These fundamental emotions connect us, whether we invite them to or not, into a world in which we are seldom the only ones celebrating, and we are never the only ones grieving. How do we increase our chances of feeling this transcendent sense of being a part of something larger than ourselves? Like Red Sox Nation, I think we do it when we forgive one another everything. When we don't turn away from our shared suffering and we stay in relationship with the world around us and the people in it, even through the lean times, never completely backing away, even after 86 years of not quite getting there. In this fragmented culture of ours, each and every individual has been trained to be a consumer, not just of goods, but of environments, of associations, and of identities. We've been trained to interact with one another when it is useful, to throw a little bit of our identity out that comes with joining in the mix only when we have sufficiently proven that an organization or institution will do for us what we want it to do. We choose to live a place when it is convenient, to stay so long as it remains such. We are consumers of life, of religion, of environments, of people. We want it as long as it works, and we're ready to bail when it doesn't. But being a part of a community means being vulnerable and honest and available to that community, even when it's not what you wish it would be. The transcendence that comes with being a part of something comes not just when the community pleases you, when it makes you happy and meets your needs, but when it lets you down and you have to find a way to love it anyway. Home is not an idyllic place. It's a real place with real people. People worth knowing and loving, complete with their foibles, failures, and very real differences. After all, look at Prince William County today. An environment in which people are so polarized and so mistrustful that it's very hard to feel any sense of community here at all. One is tempted to just throw in the towel entirely, to take away the little piece of your identity that says you live here and this is your place, and just style yourself a commuter in the vast expanse of the Washington metro region, no more truly belonging to the place you live than you belong to the gym to which you pay your dues. But if we give up, if we can't turn over even a tiny bit of our identity to the world around us, to the place we live, to the people we spend our time with, if we can't say, I am among you, you are my people, if we just throw in the towel and decide it doesn't matter where we're from, we'll never get the joy of seeing it change. We'll never get the joy of standing next to people we'd never noticed before, celebrating a turnaround we'd only dreamed of. Being in community, I think, is about allowing oneself to be passionate about something, then not expecting that something to be perfect. You remember the old quote from the movies that says, love means never having to say you're sorry? I always thought that was hooey. Love means seeing a failure, meeting a weakness, apologizing 1,000 times, and still finding a way to care. It's being a part of a love that's bigger than all the forces that pull us apart and being vulnerable to all the implications of that love. For that one moment, those fans forgave each other everything. They knew that being a part of this thing meant really being a part of it, even when it didn't entirely meet their needs, even when it didn't do their thing, even when it didn't bring home the victory, even when they had endless complaints about who was traded where and what coach did what. Being a part of that thing meant sticking it out, not giving up. It meant 86 years of loss capped off with a shining victory they would never forget. If we are to build a connection with the world around us that sustains us and that truly matters, if we are to truly be among our neighbors and community for one another, let us not be stingy with our self-identity. Let us not be stingy in giving a little piece of our soul to one another and saying with pride, these are my people, this is my place, I am among you. We are together. We're not Brew versus the world, and the surrounding area is not comprised of us and them out there. It is composed only of we, right here. and our home cannot be an alien place full of people we'd rather not associate with. It is our place. And if we can just have the courage to hand over some tiny bit of our souls, to throw in our lot with those with whom we live and work and worship, if we can let ourselves be vulnerable enough, frightening as it is, to be among the people around us, we too might be part of something bigger than ourselves. And we too might be transported by a love that outlasts even 86 years of loss. May our identities evolve and expand, pushing through the boundaries that separate us. And may we be generous of spirit, freely seeing these people, both inside and outside of these doors, as our people, even if they sometimes let us down. May it be so, and amen.